All right, this is an official Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, so we need to call to order and do the agenda. We only have one agenda item, which is the adoption of the agenda. So for the commission members that are here, is there a motion to adopt the agenda, which is training session with the Council for Government?
So moved.
So moved. Well, okay, we got to move and second it right here. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Excellent. We don't adjourn yet, so this is the training. You're on.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members, and other members. My name is Wes McLeod. I'm with Cape Fear Council of Governments. We're going to be doing a Planning and Zoning Commission training tonight. Shouldn't take too long. We'll discuss basics as it relates to the functioning of the Planning and Zoning Commission and general zoning practices. As we go through, feel free to ask questions. We can keep this informal. I do have a bit of a cold, so I apologize for that. I do have a cough drop. I will try to speak up. And I guess the last thing is, I work for Cape Fear Council of Governments as their local government services director. I've been doing this as somewhat of a planning consultant for a little over 10 years now, almost 5 years with Cape Fear Council of Governments. It's a common thing we do for our local governments to help with refresh on training-related items, and then let you guys ask any particular questions that may be on your mind. So with that, I'll jump right in. I think I will. Okay. So just to establish some framework here, it's important to understand the function with which you guys operate. So local governments in general are creatures of the state, and they have no inherent powers. But certain local governments are afforded more powers than others. For example, in home rule states, local governments have broad authority, essentially to enact any rules and regulations that don't conflict with the federal or state constitution. In Dillon's rule states, state local governments have only those powers that are granted to them by their legislature. In North Carolina, we're basically deemed a modified Dillon's rule state. And so, as you know, our state legislature sort of sets the goalposts with what we can and can't do. You've heard about preemptions for our local governments. There's a host of things that Raleigh will dictate that the local government can or can't do, particularly as it's related to planning and zoning matters. One of the most recent being a session law was passed that local governments can no longer set the minimum living area of a residential structure, one and two family structure. So, you know, a lot of our local governments, particular beach communities, had in their zoning ordinances to build in the B1 or R1, you had to have a minimum 1,500 square foot living area on your residential structure. Can no longer do that. And that is an example of a policy that's set in Raleigh that dictates how you can or can't do things. Now, the reason why I want to mention this is because it's important for you guys to understand the way in which you operate. You can't just go down some path and pass some law or new rule without out of being consistent with state law. That makes sense?
Are we being recorded?
Yes.
Okay. So be careful.
That's why I always ask.
So, there are four types of land use decisions I'm going to touch on briefly. First being legislative. Those are those decisions that are made by your governing board. You can have a public hearing. Your governing board can decide any which way they choose. They can take into account that public hearing, public comments that are received, or they cannot. Those are typical decisions like your rezonings, your text amendments, adopting a budget, annexation, etc. Those are always afforded to the governing board, your elected board. Here, that would be your town council. There's advisory decisions. These are the decisions that are primarily made by the Planning and Zoning Commission. These are not final decisions. They're less regulated, but often they're required as a part of another type of decision. For example, anytime a text amendment is adopted or rezoning occurs, you guys have to have a consistency statement and send a recommendation to your town council. So, and the other important part of this is of an advisory decision is they're not appealable. So a citizen can't appeal an advisory decision of the planning board or an advisory decision of a staff member that says, I think you can do that, but I'm not sure. And that's an important distinction as well. Third is an administrative decision. These are your routine activities. Anytime the inspector, Mr. Batson, issues a zoning permit, for example, or a building permit, that's an administrative decision, and it's also final. So if someone's not happy with that decision, it can be appealed to the Board of Adjustment. There's also administrative decisions that can be granted to the Planning and Zoning Commission, for example. Right now, you guys don't have any of those powers granted to you, but in many jurisdictions, preliminary plats or subdivision plats are approved by the Planning Board. That's an administrative decision by the Planning and Zoning Commission. Here, that preliminary plat or subdivision plat is reviewed only for an advisory recommendation before final approval of the town council. And even though that subdivision plat goes to your town council, it's still an administrative decision, even though it is at your town council governing board level. And I did point out that appealing a legislative decision is a different function than appealing an administrative decision. So if someone is displeased with a rezoning, for example, they have to pursue court action in pursuit of their relief. They can't appeal that rezoning action, for example, to the Board of Adjustment. Board of Adjustment does not have that authority.
Likewise for subdivision decisions.
And, well, if it is approved by the town council as an administrative decision, there needs to be somewhere someone can be granted relief. And I don't know where it is in your ordinance.
Don't the general statutes give subdivision appeals to the court, Superior Court?
Only if it would have been decided by the Board of Adjustment. So because it would be an administrative decision, and it depends on each jurisdiction, and this is where it gets squirrely when you have administrative decisions approved by the governing board, because it doesn't necessarily make sense to say, well, the governing board didn't approve this, I'm going to appeal it to the Board of Adjustment, which is presumably an appointed board of that council. And that's why sometimes it's a good idea not to have those administrative decisions at the council level. If that makes sense.
Just question, is that a recommendation to put the administrative decisions either to staff or the P&Z?
That's usually a recommendation that I push forward. However, every jurisdiction does it how they want to do it.
Okay.
For example, you guys aren't going to have a lot of subdivisions. So maybe it makes sense to have extra eyes on the project going through that, both the Planning and Zoning Board and the Town Council for approval. There's multiple jurisdictions in this area that they function exactly that same fashion, many of them actually. So it's not outside the norm, but there are just procedural logistics that can cause problems, as was just alluded to. Because the fact of the matter is, if, and this is where the trouble lies, and I'll mention this later, if that subdivision plat meets all the requirements of the ordinance, it has to be approved. And when you're an elected official and you've got a large contingent of your constituents in the room saying, we don't want this subdivision, you have no choice but to approve it because it meets the standards of the ordinance. If you deny it, it'll be immediately appealed and overturned. That's the tricky part. The last is the most fun, quasi-judicial. Those are actions, decisions where discretion is applied. And so quasi-judicial essentially functions like a miniature courtroom. So those decisions are based on evidentiary hearings. They're different than public hearings. Those are your special or conditional use permits, variances, appeals. It's a very formal structure in terms of the way those meetings are handled as well. And depending on the decision, that authority can be granted to your planning and zoning committee, planning and zoning commission, or your town council. Here, your variances and appeals are heard by your board of adjustment, and then your special use permits are heard by your town council with an advisory recommendation for your planning and zoning commission. That's also common, but also can be problematic. It potentially limits the impartiality that applicant is supposed to have by virtue of the fact that it goes through two different hearings rather than just one. All right, so when I say planning board, it also means planning commission, planning and zoning commission, planning and zoning board, etc. You guys call it planning and zoning commission here, and that's completely fine. But just know I'm not talking about a different place or a different board. It's the same one. NCGS 160A 361 spells out the statutory requirements about establishing a planning board in order to enact zoning. The requirements are 3 members minimum, and then all meetings, of course, are subject to open meetings requirement, but other details can be left up to the local government. So, for example, in some beach towns, historically, they've had non-resident participation because they can't fill the board because there's so few permanent residents, for example. That's a unique distinction there. But there's usually 5 or 7, usually a quorum is a simple majority. As I stated, some have non-resident participation. Folks sometimes stipulate they need to have special qualifications. And then obviously you're going to set terms, vacancies, attendance, etc. So the statutory powers of a planning board, this is right from the statute. These are things that the planning board is granted authority to do. And these are from the old enabling statutes, mind you. So remember, 60 years ago, the planning board functioned in a different fashion than it does today. But these are all the things that are in that statute. Make studies of the area, determine the objectives to be sought in the development of the study area, prepare and adopt plans, develop, and one of the things that you guys still certainly do, develop and recommend policies, ordinances, administrative procedures, advise the council concerning the use and amendment of means for carrying out plans, exercise any function of administration and enforcement of carrying out plans and any other duties that the council directs you. You guys are likely engaged in reviewing policies, developing policies, reviewing ordinances, things of that nature. Many, many years ago, there may not have been staff, and the planning board was actually doing work of that staff member or that planner themselves. And so that's why the statute reads to some degree in that fashion. So the responsibilities of the Curie Beach Planning and Zoning Commission: recommendation on text amendments and zoning map amendments, rezonings, that's required by state law. Make recommendations on special use permits and subdivision plats. That's not required by state law, that's just a local rule that you guys have. And then, of course, any other related duties assigned by town council. Typical actions. These are things that I would anticipate that if you've been on the board for a while, you perhaps have been involved in. Recommendation of text amendments to zoning regulations. Recommendations of rezonings, whether you want to recommend approval or denial. PRD master plans, PUD master plans. Most of Curie Beach is now built out, so you're not likely going to have any of these really coming down the pike anytime soon, but this would be a typical function that you would do. Review and approval of major subdivision preliminary plats, and then recommendations on land use plans, transportation plans, etc. So, I think one of the things, at least in some of my discussion, is that you guys have been involved in ordinance amendments and have been involved in working on ordinances. So some of the basics are, anytime there's a proposed amendment to your zoning ordinance, it must be submitted to the planning board for review and comment. Now, there's a stipulation in there in the state statute that says if you don't provide a recommendation following, I believe it's 60 days, and it can be sent to the council for approval. But in the statute says it has to be sent to you initially. The other piece, which is relatively new, is that planning board must provide a written recommendation addressing plan consistency with that proposed amendment. So every amendment that comes to you, you are supposed to look at the amendment and look at the land use plan in a written fashion, in a unique statement, say, this ordinance amendment is consistent with our land use plan because of XYZ. Or this amendment is not consistent with our land use plan because of XYZ. Whether it is or whether it isn't doesn't matter whatsoever. The statute just says you have to do it. And then the third piece where, depending on the relationship between the planning board and the governing board, the planning board may not be in favor of a particular amendment, and they may recommend denial. The town council can choose to go along with that recommendation, or they can choose to approve the ordinance amendment. At the end of the day, they're the elected board, and what you have to say doesn't necessarily matter. So these are some key considerations whenever a text amendment comes before you. So is the first and foremost, if nothing else, you have to say, is the amendment consistent with the approved plan? Now that statement isn't subject to judicial review, so can almost say anything. The statute just says that we have to talk about consistency with the plan. Is the amendment in the public interest? These are things that you should be considering. And, you know, I won't read all these, but these are all just considerations that are generally put forth. And some ordinances actually include language similar to this in their zoning ordinance for when amendments are addressed, things that the planning board or the town council must consider. So, you know, one of the things that folks often get lost on is, you know, how the amendment will affect existing development and will it create nonconformities. By adopting this amendment, is it going to create a huge headache for our staff moving forward and our town moving forward? Zoning map amendments, key considerations. Again, is the amendment or rezoning consistent with approved plans? You at least have a map that you can look at when you're doing a rezoning, and that's your future land use map. That's a land use plan version of your zoning map. So if you're...
Just real quick, on the prior slide, you're non-conforming. You know, from my experience, because a lot of zoning might have been created 50, 60 years ago, mm-hmm. way towns and cities improve, mm-hmm. is ultimately they're going to create things that do create non-conformities. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how you
yes.
make things nicer, mm-hmm. is that does the consistency plan have to identify non-conformities?
No, it does not.
Okay. So you can create non-conformities that may have to be dealt with them by staff or something like that through a process,
yes.
an amortization process or whatever. But that doesn't have to be specified in the consistency.
Absolutely not. Okay. It's just something that you should consider. You know, if a staff member preparing a staff report, if I'm preparing a staff report, I would say you were going to increase the setbacks to 25 feet or something. Mm-hmm. Well, 90% of your structures have a 5-foot setback, and you're going to create 95% nonconformity. Is that a good idea to do? Now, that's an extreme example, but something that you should consider. And if it is, then maybe you need to say that for 1 in 2 family structures that are structural nonconformities, they can rebuild in their existing footprint. Just things like that should be considered. You don't have to address that, though, in the consistency statement. And we have plenty of example consistency statements, I'm sure if Beth or someone and staff wanted to request one, we'd be happy to send them to you. But that's a great question. Thank you. So back to rezoning. These are a little bit more, and I don't know how many rezonings you guys have. Probably not that often. You know, when's the last time you had a rezoning?
We've had one rezoning request in the last 15 years. Is this such a K form?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's frankly that's fairly typical for a beach community that is, you know, doesn't have any mainland property, for example. So you're not outside the norm. So it really, this doesn't necessarily apply to you, but these are the things that you should consider if you did have a rezoning come before you. You know, you want to make sure that you want to understand the character of the surrounding area, impacts on neighbors, etc. You know, dealing with spot zoning is another issue. Should the change be applied to one or more specific properties? There's also text amendments that perhaps could be used to accomplish the same goal rather than a rezoning. And then the other thing that often gets left, and since you guys haven't had a lot of rezonings, this isn't something that really applies to you, but what happens is a developer or realtor comes and said, we're going to build this fantastic, you know, community recreation center or some other thing that is desired by the community. It's a permitted use in the commercial district. And they tell you what they're going to build. But you can't take that into consideration. You got to take into consideration all the other permissible uses in that district. Because that person may walk out the door after it gets approved and they get hit by a bus and then comes in a gas station or some other use or something that the community doesn't want. Well, you've just granted this rezoning approval. And now all the other permissible uses can be used on that property. Or the property is sold. It's another thing that commonly happens. Folks can get caught up on some things. These are generally things that are not appropriate to consider whenever you're granting approval to someone. It's not appropriate to consider the applicant, their identity, their race, gender, etc. Are they well-liked? Is it a chain, etc.? Is the property going to be owner-occupied or for rent? Is it going to be low-income versus high-income? This is another one that happens sometimes. Well, we don't want to approve this because we feel like this is a speculative investment and it's going to wither on the vine. That's not under your authority. If it's an administrative zoning type approval, it needs to be approved. But these are things that are generally not to be considered for zoning matters. Certain uses and other items are granted special consideration. Cell towers is one. Small cell wireless are granted essentially special approval. That's another preemption by our state legislature. Signs are something that's occurred recently through a Supreme Court case. We can regulate size, the type, lighting, etc., but we are not supposed to regulate the content of those signs. Manufactured housing is another one that folks can get caught up on. You need to allow for manufactured housing somewhere, and you can't exclude based on or regulate based on the age of the structure. And then single family and duplex housing. There was an effort underway some years ago to regulate the design of single family structures outside of a historic district. And the state legislature said, nope, they put the kibosh on that. So one and two family structures, we're not allowed to regulate any design unless they are in a historic district. And then another thing that was happening about 15 years ago, folks were imposing moratoriums to adopt ordinances. Legislature has now said you cannot impose a moratorium purely to adopt a development ordinance to stop development. Yes, sir.
Question on signs, Wes.
Yes.
Seeing how planning and zoning offers recommendations on the type of businesses that are allowed in an area, don't you have ability to talk about content on a sign, for example, an X-rated sign of some type, You can't.
There are certain signs. When it comes to adult business, there's a statute that allows you to regulate obscene material.
Okay, as so it's one. Not 100% state.
Not 100%. Although, our attorney's here, so I don't know if he wanted to weigh in on that. I'm not sure how the Supreme Court would find on that. Frankly, I'm unsure how anyone can regulate signs without, to some degree, regulating the content.
Well, you can draft regulations that are pretty much content neutral. I mean, I've done it in a couple of jurisdictions and no issues yet.
It's very hard. So for the two ones that are really hard, real estate signs and political signs.
Yeah. I don't recall exactly how we did it, but we do have an informational sign category that kind of skirts around that issue. But
my impression, and what I've always been told by attorneys, is that when it comes to commercial signs, the Supreme Court has a lot more
yes.
flexibility in terms of regulation.
That's correct.
When it comes to political signs, that's a freedom of expression and freedom of speech and all that sort of thing. So we don't regulate content. We do regulate signs, lighting, mm-hmm. and things like that. Is that a state rule, or I don't... my understanding that the Supreme Court would allow some regulation for commercial content.
They afford a difference between commercial and non-commercial to some degree, that you're allowed to have a little bit more discretion on commercial signage. There's been a number of lower court cases that have come back one side or the other, back and forth, about the issue.
The bottom line is it's First Amendment is complex. You got to do your homework to make sure whatever's being proposed passes muster. It's not a off the top of your head answer.
That's
I mean, we don't regulate content here, so I don't think we've ever tried to regulate content. But you're right. I mean, we do have things like
that. Well, and it goes beyond that. You know, there's a lot of older ordinances that say they call out the sign type by the content that's on it. They don't necessarily say your sign can't say XYZ, but the sign name itself may be gas station sign or something to that effect, and that's where the trouble can come in. We haven't had a lot of lawsuits come up about this type of a thing. In fact, we still have state statutes on the books for putting political signs in state right-of-way, which is, in violation of that Supreme Court ruling and in conflict with it, certainly. Nothing has necessarily come down except the Supreme Court says that you need to be content neutral.
So basically, with no content, there's no provision for them to come before the town or city and say, we're going to put this type of content in there. So they basically go ahead and do what they want to do.
Well, I don't know. I'm not familiar with their sign ordinance, but I guess that there are certain sign types that you have.
Sign types, content.
If it meets regulations, lighting, everything, you sign up, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That sign, that scroll, the Sunoco, remember that, Craig? Mm-hmm. How do we go against that? Was that
just it was a violation of the type of sign.
Type of sign.
Yep. It was type.
So
I did not mean to derail.
No, so that's okay.
Yeah,
but that's
nothing is absolute because that's why we have
lawyers,
attorneys, and why we have courtrooms.
Yeah, right? That's right.
What's right?
No, but and that's so that scrolling sign, or lots of times they would have a temperature and date sign, right? So a lot of ordinances refer to them as temperature and date signs. Well, obviously that is a content based. Mm-hmm. regulation, correct? But you can call it an electronic message center sign. We don't care that it says temperature or date, or you could say we don't allow any electronic message center. So that would be an example. Plat versus site plan. This is sometimes folks confuse this. You guys all seem to know be pretty well up to speed on a lot of these things, so this is likely a refresher for you. Site plan would be the gas station, for example. Someone comes in on a on an existing site, they want to build a commercial structure, or someone has a platted lot and they want to put a new home on there. They need to meet the dimensional requirements of the zoning ordinance and any other rules and regulations. Plat would be a map or plan prepared by a surveyor of a piece of land. A subdivision plat is a plat prepared explicitly for the purpose of subdividing land, and there's a whole host of rules and regulations that coincide with approving that subdivision plat. Oftentimes, unless it's an exempt plat per statutes, there will be a preliminary plat that lays out all the required infrastructure that's supposed to be in place before the final plat is approved. Once that final plat's approved, someone can go to the Register of Deeds, record that plat, and then convey those lots to third parties. Again, you guys aren't going to have a lot of this, and in fact, the government, local governments that do, this is one of the more complicated things that they have to deal with. I'll just touch briefly on this, and because I understand you guys have had training on this, but quasi-judicial decisions, again, are required where discretion is applied. The decision needs to be based on standards in your ordinance. The burden of proof is on the applicant to show that the standards have been satisfied. And then if sufficient evidence is presented that shows the standards have been met, the board needs to approve the permit or overturn an appeal or uphold an appeal, etc. However, if there's contradictory evidence presented, the board has to figure out which evidence is essentially most correct. Questions about that?
Good. You probably have a slide, the next slide, but special use permits, conditional use, rezoning, administrative appeals. There you go.
I don't go into administrative appeals, but I can talk about them. So special use permit considerations and findings, these are right from the statute. So anyone that wants to come in and apply for a special use permit, there's four minimum conditions that they need to meet. And these, I always recommend that these always be voted on by your board. One, first being that the use does not materially endanger the public health or safety. There needs to be some evidence to that fact. Two, the use meets all required conditions and specifications of the ordinance. Obviously, if a site plan showing all the dimensional standards are met, et cetera, any other landscaping standards, that the use is permitted, that can satisfy that finding. Third, this is the complicated one, that the use would not substantially injure the value of adjoining property or be a public necessity. So how would you determine that the use would not substantially injure the value of adjoining property? Well, someone is going to build a hotel next to my property, it is going to injure the value of my property. My property is going to go down, certainly. There's going to be transients next door all the time, lots of traffic. Definitely my property value is going to go down. So, and I come in as a citizen with standing and I say that to the board. Should the board find an affirmative? So, should they be granted a special use permit based on my testimony?
No. You'd have to prove it.
How would I do that?
Let's give them a hint by spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
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 It's the type of study that we showed in neighboring towns, duplicate issue.
Not quite, but you're on the right path. So I'm not an appraiser. I'm not a professional that is qualified to render that decision, right? So it goes back to and we're not getting into quasi-judicial here, but it goes back to having substantial, competent, and material evidence. So I need an appraiser's report certifying that fact.
I would have to disagree on that because there's a lot of research. I'm an economist, and there's a tremendous amount of research that looks at the impact of certain type of developments and that sort of thing, which are not appraisers. So I've seen many, many times where somebody can come in, let's say, and I've testified, you know, before boards in this, where I would come in and people are talking about maybe allowing bed and breakfasts or something like that as a special use permit, and you go in and you can show that, you know, that there's a number of empirical studies in the United States or North Carolina that shows that there's a decrease in value. I'm not an appraiser, so sure. I'm not assessing that particular situation. I think that satisfies that requirement.
By statute, I think it's 168.393 that sets forth the standards, procedures, and requirements for appealing a quasi-judicial decision in the nature of certiorari that has two express provisions that concern the red button issues that always come up. And they say that non-expert opinion testimony regarding property values is inadmissible. And that
I've been declared an expert in this, but I'm not an appraiser.
I'm just saying the statute says for you to prove your point about traffic impact or property values, you have to do it through an expert witness.
I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that because you can be a property value expert without being an appraiser.
Granted, I had a trial with a chiropractor who got injured in a rear-end accident. I qualified the plaintiff as his own expert witness, and that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I have no problem with the definition of an expert, but that doesn't exclude or only include an appraiser to make that decision.
It would be up to the superior court who would be reviewing the record for them to determine whether or not, in fact, the evidence could be.
Right. That's a point well taken. If you take that approach, and it's too bad the Board of Adjustment's not here, you'd have to take pains to make sure you qualified yourself as an expert in front of the.
So just bringing in research isn't sufficient. That person who brings in the research would have to testify
and
would be reasonably qualified as an expert in that particular area. Okay, that's fine. Okay.
Fourth, that the use will be in harmony with the area in which it's located and be in general conformity with the comprehensive plan. And this is quite discretionary here. And a reason why the special use permit has to be issued through a quasi-judicial process. So the applicant needs to have some sort of proof, evidence, or thought as to how exactly that will be accomplished, or risk having their permit denied. All right.
Just very quickly, I've always struggled with the definition of harmony. To me, that's a more difficult one than the prior number three, to be honest. How in the world would you, I mean, I think we all have a sense of whether something is harmonious with what we're trying to do, but how would you deal with that in terms of a finding where somebody says it's not harmonious? I mean, again, the neighbor might come in and say, well, it's not in harmony with my your hotel example.
Right.
I may not even have to deal with number three. I can just simply say it's not harmonious with the neighborhood.
Well,
and how would you debate that issue?
One, the neighbor has to have special standing to even speak, you know, during that hearing. But it's a very, you know, is a hotel harmonious in the middle of a residential neighborhood? Absolutely not. Is a two-family structure harmonious in the middle of mixed two-family and one-family structures? Probably so. But one of the things that you use as your guide, and that's why it's important to have one of these, is and be reasonably updated, is your comprehensive plan that spells out the things that our community should be, the things that certain areas should be, and spells out, you know, in some descriptive terms, within this particular future land use area, these are the things that are supported. I don't know if, I mean, you...
Yeah, I agree. You can find support in your land use plans. That doesn't mean it's going to carry the day.
Right.
Three is pretty strong if you can make that case. Four is very nebulous.
Yeah, four is very nebulous.
I do have a question. Something I've always struggled with is, what is a comprehensive plan? I know some jurisdictions whose land use plans piggyback on the county, but in skeletal form. And you can't find support in those plans for consistency statements or leverage. So I often refer to the policy inherent in that jurisdiction's zoning ordinance, because all the things that you need are there. In your opinion, can a comprehensive plan include a zoning ordinance?
I need to go back and look at 168.383, but I believe the most recent amendment includes the comprehensive plan definition also includes unified development ordinance,
right,
which would mean zoning ordinance to me. But yes, the comprehensive plans, now statute refers to them as comprehensive plans, but it's also your land use plan. People call them 10 different names, CAMA land use plans, etc. And I will also mention that new statute that will become effective in 2021 will require all jurisdictions that want to enforce zoning or administer zoning regulations have a, quote, reasonably updated comprehensive plan.
That was actually going to be my next question, because in California, you have to update your comprehensive plan every 5 years, and there's actually legal consequences if you don't. Mm-hmm. To the point where if it's 7 or 8 years old, then that would create a problem if somebody, through a quasi-judicial process, might challenge, mm-hmm. you know, a special use permit or something. Mm-hmm. I don't think ours is... What was it? Ours?
Yours is old.
It's a long time. Okay, so that was going to be my question, is that... It doesn't sound like it's an issue now, given that we're somewhat dated on our land use plan, but as of 2021, it may become...
Probably a good idea to start thinking about, you know, I don't know what reasonably updated means. I think we're going to learn a bit more about what that means, but I think, you know, 5 to 7 years is the general rule of thumb. 5 years.
So what are we, 12 right now?
12 years.
We're 12, okay.
5 years seems quick, because oftentimes it takes 2 years to do anything, and then you're turning right around and doing
so your suggestion is that we're 12 years, we may want to start thinking about
doing it, yeah.
Doing it pretty soon.
Yeah, I would think so.
Get the overlay done.
You might want to replace May with
part of it.
Yeah. Yes, it may be a shall. That's correct. Just a couple more, and then get you guys out of here or answer any questions that you guys have. Conflict of interest, this is right from 168.381D. Members of appointed, and this same goes for your elected board as well, members of appointed boards providing advice shall not vote on anything in which is considered reasonably likely to have a direct, substantial, and readily identifiable financial impact on the member. So if there's questions about conflict of interest, if you feel like you're going to have a conflict, one, you can always run it by your town attorney prior to the meeting, or two, you can bring it up during the meeting and say whatever your relationship is to the particular item, or three, just recuse yourself out of safety. So this is the test, is whether a reasonable person would question whether the decision is based on the merits of the case or some alternative motive. Don't have a whole lot of guidance here, but it's a general rule of thumb. And then that member must abstain from voting, but may participate in deliberations, although it is certainly not advisable. I will always recommend that they leave the rostrum and go sit in the audience until that agenda item is passed. Because what happens if you sit there is you can't oftentimes help but interject and participate in the conversation. Open meetings laws, this is again right from the statute, essentially the policy of North Carolina that hearings, deliberations, and actions of all these bodies be conducted openly. This meeting is being recorded. It was advertised, so you guys are good with your open meeting laws requirements. Each official meeting of a public body shall be open to the public. Anybody is entitled to attend such a meeting, but that doesn't mean that they're entitled to speak at the meeting. You guys can determine, unless there's a public hearing, how you want to handle public comment on a particular item. Some jurisdictions have two options for public comment. Some don't have any. Some have limits on time. Everybody handles that different. People often ask, what is an official meeting? It's a gathering, basically, of the majority of the members of a public body. Now, what about a group text message? That's a majority of the members.
Members, yeah.
Text message about public business?
Or a text message about public business. It's a big no-no.
Would a text message about, as long as there's not a, and I would agree with you, but I'm just kind of wondering, you could have a text message without a conversation, responses, and, you know, carrying a conversation. Is a text message about something a conversation or a meeting or assembly, or do you need to have some sort of a back and forth type of thing?
Well, so that would sort of be similar to, so if there's a social gathering that the majority of the members attend, obviously you're not necessarily going to advertise that meeting, but what you can't do, what you don't want to do, is discuss any official business of the town. But as a general rule of thumb, group text messages of your boards is a bad, bad idea.
Yeah, from a risk management standpoint, it risks being a violation of the open meetings law, giving anybody the private right to come in to court and seek to nullify the action taken.
So, no, I would agree with you, and it's very tempting sometimes, I have to admit. Yeah. Email to give your comments on something. I think we've all probably been...
And the corollary,
done that at one time or another.
The corollary to that is in civil litigation, there's been a tremendous emphasis over the past 5 years on being able to discover electronically stored information.
Yes.
To the extent that larger firms have IT personnel who, on behalf of their clients, come in and mirror their cell phones and search their cell phones for electronically stored information that is responsive to discovery requests. So, okay, the best thing is just to...
Let me ask you another question, which is something that we've done, and I do it too, is not discussing, but providing information, where, let's say that there's a... I'll give a real example. Let's say we're talking about, proposing a new type of ordinance or something like that. So I go out and I research, and I find 14 different examples, and I shoot it out as an email attachment to the board. No conversation, just simply providing information. Because I've done that. I don't know how that would fall.
That's either open meetings or public records, both of which can be defeated with the heading attorney-client privilege.
And yes, yep. And the other thing is, what I always recommend, you want to send something to your board, send it to your clerk, and she will get it into the appropriate hands.
Oh, and okay.
Yes.
So if I want to do something, because it's information we're not talking about, it, but it's information people may want to read or look at this stuff before they come in, because it may take an hour to read it. So the best thing to do is send it to the clerk, who then would send it to the board.
I don't want to speak for... I don't want to get in the middle of you guys, how you handle communications.
But it makes sense.
Do you want...
I mean, that makes sense to me. Yeah. Surely.
If it's related to public business, they should screenshot it, send it to us, and we can put it in the file. And that way we're documenting it.
And if you put the attorney-client privileged header on there, make sure that the attorney is CC'd, and make sure nobody outside of the town is CC'd, because otherwise you waive the privilege.
Okay.
you need the attorney to have the privilege. You put somebody outside on that string, you've lost the privilege.
And, you know, typically you would, where attorney-client privilege typically comes in is if there is a matter that you don't necessarily, it pertains to a particular case or some other item that really you need to be having dialogue with the attorney, or the attorney needs to be aware of to be able to disclose it to other folks. If you're researching an ordinance or something like that, that should just send it to the clerk. And
back up one second. I'm not trying to change the topic here on that, but you've got in there including teleconference and other electronic conference.
Yes.
Can you talk about that some more?
Email, phone calls, all fall under this.
Yeah, so you're talking just in general stuff, not specifically on meetings themselves.
You should think about it as any correspondence whatsoever, in whatever form or fashion it may be.
But you're not talking about, for example, Craig and I do it back to back. It's if I did it as a whole group.
Or if we include majority.
Majority of the members.
The majority of the members. So we could communicate. Yeah.
But also, as a general rule of thumb, it is not good to discuss business, official business, outside of any meeting.
It would still be a public record.
Yeah, and it would still be discoverable and public record.
Well, yeah, discoverable doesn't bother. Yeah. We're not doing anything bad. I mean, I don't mind discoverable. I just don't want to violate this. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we've done anything that we're worried about.
Now, this is obviously different from private areas, for example, in HOA, where I was president for a while. If I had an electronic message sent to the entire board, it was subject to subpoena. Mm-hmm. But if I did it one-on-one with somebody, it was not subject to subpoena. Is this different?
The attorney will have to answer that question. I don't know where the HOA rules fall. Yeah. I would think it would still be discoverable, but I don't know.
Yeah, you'd have to look at it case by case, but to make things efficient and keep things cheap, just don't engage in those practices.
Or send it to the clerk, who would then send
put the burden on Beth. Right. Let Beth figure it out.
Yep. All right. That's it. So that's all I have for you tonight. But certainly, you guys had a bunch of great questions. If you have any more, please, I'll be happy to entertain them.
I've got a question, because we're in the process of looking at a historic district. And so we have gone through a formal process on the advice of the attorney to set up a separate historic preservation commission that meets separately. Now, it's made up of the same people as the P&Z, but we have definitely separated the two in that type of process.
We have two hats.
Yeah, so we wear two hats. How familiar are you with that process of historic, setting up historic districts and historic preservation commission making recommendations and so forth?
I mean, depends on what your end goal is in mind. You know, what are you looking to achieve through that commission? That commission will need to have a set of guidelines.
Right, which we already do, yes. We've been meeting for several months already.
Issue certificates of appropriateness, and that's prior to the issuance of any building permit, and that's a quasi-judicial process also. Mm-hmm. And that's for demolition, includes demolition as well.
We're still in early phases, so once hopefully it's established, we'll deal with COAs and things like that. But the process of getting from thinking about it to where we actually have one, it will probably be over the next several months that we're going to be doing that. Do you have any insights as to how to facilitate that process or make it faster, better, more appropriate, or anything like that?
That's a good question. And I am not an expert on historic districts. I would just make sure, you probably are handling it, make sure it's done in the light of day. You probably want to have some public meetings about it, perhaps have some sort of public survey instrument about the things that would be included in those guidelines, as it would help help you come to your conclusion when you're granting those certificates of appropriateness. But other than that, I mean, similar to setting up any other commission, it'll be a lot of work.
Okay.
I don't think I helped you very much there.
Wade, Wes, I really appreciate your time tonight. I think this was helpful for all of us. Was it okay if we sent this out to everybody in case
of course.
Were copying?
Yep.
I think it's definitely some good information.
Yep.
I agree.
Some definitions and everything.
Should be given there a new board.
I do have one more question. We have two interns here. That one is working with the planning and zoning on a couple projects, and another is working with the historic district in terms of assisting in terms of looking at these issues. Neither one is employed by the city or town.
Yeah.
Do you have any, when you have other folks outside, experts, interns, or things like that, are there any special rules or concerns or cautions in that type of situation?
You mean in terms of their liability, or
you know, with the whole communication, range, anything that pops to mind that we should be concerned about, because I could see
that
Curie Beach could have a number of interns in the future, you know, with its relationship with UNCW and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, we have interns through our organization quite often, back through the MPA program.
Do you all have an internship policy?
We don't. We do pay them. And if they work over a certain number of hours, then it triggers us them being have to participate in state retirement system, things of that nature. But we don't have a set-in-stone policy. We probably should. But we find it's a very beneficial thing for both sides. One, they... you know, get to learn about some things, and two, we get some help with things. You know, and these guys are students, so they will be very helpful of things, but you shouldn't
abuse them
or expect or expect to them to be seasoned professionals, and they're not professing to be either, but just, you know, a word to the wise.
But electronic communication with them should go under the same rules at the board. If they want to send something to go through the clerk.
Yep.
Okay.
That, I mean,
sorry about
that. I don't know how Beth, you can answer that. I mean, you may not need to do that.
That might be more of an attorney question.
I mean, if some board member has been tasked with looking at something, it may not be that big of a deal to have some dialogue back and forth. It's not open meetings, but it is discoverable, as was mentioned. Thank you guys again.
Thank you.
We do this once a year for all local governments at no charge, so...
And we're getting a copy of that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Everybody already has it in
there. He said he's
already been distributed out.
Okay.
All right. Again, this is because it's a formal meeting. Is there a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Want to do a second?
Second.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.